From WYPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. One 100 years ago, a group of Goucher students picketed the White House over the objections of the school's president to demand the right to vote for women. Today, we look at why even some supporters of women's suffrage disagreed with that picket, and at the role the state of Maryland played in opposing the 19th Amendment. Goucher alumna Hannah Spiegelman takes us behind the scenes of an exhibit at Goucher about the picket. And writer Elaine Weiss explains the tremendous obstacles impeding ratification of the 19th Amendment in 1920.
The way you won suffrage from the state is you either had the state legislature change the state constitution, which was very, very difficult, or you had to have a referendum where only the male voters could vote.
It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. February 12, 1906. Thousands of suffragists from around the United States gathered at the Lyric Theater in Baltimore to attend the National American Woman Suffrage Association's 38th annual convention. It would be another 13 years before Congress would pass the 19th Amendment, another year beyond that before three-fourths of the states would ratify it. One of those who spoke in Baltimore in 1906, activist Susan B. Anthony, age 85. She would die a month later. Her message to attendees, quote, "Most of those who worked with me in the early years have gone. I am here for a little time only, and then my place will be filled as theirs was filled. The fight must not cease. You must see that it does not stop." Close quote. Today, an exhibit at Goucher College honors the centennial of Goucher students picketing the White House over the objections of Goucher's then-president. We talk about why even some supporters of women's suffrage disagreed with that picket and about the role the state of Maryland played in opposing the 19th Amendment. Joining me is journalist and author Elaine Weiss. She wrote Fruits of Victory, The Woman's Land Army in the Great War, which tells the story of the farmettes who worked to feed the nation during World War I. Now she's just finished writing another book about the winning of women's suffrage in the United States to be published by Viking Press next March. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheila.
And also here is Hannah Spiegelman, a history major who graduated from Goucher in 2015. She worked with the school library special collections department and with history professor Dr. Tina Scheller to create the exhibit A Nursery for Militant Suffragists, The History of the Women's Suffrage Movement. Hannah, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with this moment 100 years ago in 1917 when young female college students are protesting at the White House. Elaine, describe the state of the suffrage movement at that time.
The suffrage movement was split at that time in 1917. The National American Women's Suffrage Association, which had been established by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, had been working for 60 years, actually a little less than that, to try to establish suffrage in the states because voting is a state-given right. And then Alice Paul comes along in about 1913 and says, this is ridiculous. It's going too slowly. We need to go for a federal amendment where all American women will be given the vote. And so there really is a split in the movement. And the strategies of Alice Paul and the Women's Party, who are picketing at the White House, are really condemned by what are called the mainstream suffragists led by Carrie Chapman Catt.
Let me make sure I understand. The mainstream suffragists you described were still working state by state?
They were on a dual track at this point. In 1916, Carrie Chapman Catt resumes the presidency. She had been president before at the turn of the century. She comes back and she says, okay, we're going to go on a dual track. It's called the winning plan. She has the state's suffrage associations pledge that they will work both for to get some states, some crucial states like New York, in the win column for suffrage. Because the way you won suffrage from the state is you either had the state legislature change the state constitution, which was very, very difficult, or you had to have a referendum where only the male voters could vote. So you were asking men, you were really at all of these stages, you're asking men to give women the vote. Women had no say in this. And so what happens is they try now to supersede the states with a federal constitutional amendment, which was introduced in 1878 and written by Stanton and Susan B. Anthony.
And in 1917, 100 years ago, the United States was just entering World War I.
Mm-hmm.
How did that affect this issue?
On the one hand, Carrie Chapman Catt is a pacifist, but she decides, as the British suffragists had decided in 1914, that it was better to pledge the work of the women of America, especially the suffragists, to work for the war effort on the home front. It was against her personal convictions, but she said, we are going to support the war effort. Alice Paul is a Quaker. And she says, no, we are not going to support the war effort. We are just going to fight for suffrage and condemn Woodrow Wilson, who is trying to rally the country to enter the war, to make the world safe for democracy. And they say, there's no democracy at home. That's hypocritical.
Hannah, where does the title for the exhibit at Goucher come from, A Nursery for Militant Suffragists?
It's from an editorial written in the Baltimore Sun. So basically when the National Woman's Party began their picketing plan, Goucher students heard of it, wanted to participate, but as soon as the Goucher president, William Guth, got word of this, he banned them. And a lot of people in Baltimore heard it was a very controversial issue, and an editorial was written agreeing with Guth, saying that if Goucher was merely a nursery for militant suffragists, it would fail as a college.
So A Nursery for Militant Suffragists was a pejorative.
Yes.
What set militant suffragists apart from other supporters of women's suffrage?
So Alice Paul and the National Woman's Party were seen as militant, despite them never using violence. It was this weird line that they crossed where they went from being just passive, shy women quietly asking for the vote to these women who would dare to stand outside the president's house with banners day after day asking for the vote that way. Alice Paul did get some ideas from the British militant suffragists who did use violence, but again, she was a Quaker, so she did not personally think that violence was necessary. But they were so adamant about the vote must happen now that they took that extra step. And then when they were arrested for picketing, they went on hunger strikes, and that was also seen as a more militant tactic.
So tell us what the exhibit includes.
So the exhibit has a timeline of Goucher's involvement in the suffrage movement and various newspaper articles, photos, brochures of the time that Goucher has been involved. So Goucher was involved starting in the 1890s. There are various professors who were supporters of the suffrage movement, wanted their students to talk about it. And then they participated in the 1906 convention that you mentioned, leading up to the pickets. They were part of parades, various other things.
That's Hannah Spiegelman here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Hannah Spiegelman helped research and design an exhibit commemorating the 100th anniversary of Goucher College students picketing the White House. Also with us is author Elaine Weiss, who's written a book to be published next spring about women's suffrage. Hannah, let's talk about some of the key figures featured in the exhibit. You mentioned the president of Goucher College, William Guth. You said he banned students.
He didn't technically ban them. He just greatly disapproved of them going, but it was kind of implied that you better not go and embarrass the school. And the students decided that they would go as individuals and not as representatives of the school. But a photo was taken of them by the Baltimore Sun. Their names were in newspaper articles. It just sort of happened that there was this publicity, and it was known that Goucher students attended this picket. So Guth had to have a public announcement.
But he himself did not oppose suffrage.
No, yeah, he actually was, in 1914 when he was inaugurated, he was the first male president of a women's college to come out in support of suffrage. But again, there were many suffragists who disagreed with the militant actions of the National Woman's Party.
There's also a member of the Goucher faculty, Lillian Welsh, who supported women's suffrage and actually helped plan that 1906 convention I mentioned at the top of the show. Tell us about Lillian Welsh.
Yeah, Lillian Welsh was monumental for bringing suffrage to Goucher and really getting students involved. She was a physician, had studied at the University of Zurich, came back to Baltimore, or actually moved to Baltimore. She was from Pennsylvania with her companion, Dr. Mary Sherwood. They tried to open up a practice, but because they were women, it was really difficult. And so she was hired by Goucher to do incoming medical examinations on students, and she quickly became a full professor. She taught physiology, hygiene. She taught a class on love. She was really beloved by the students, and she encouraged them to discuss women's rights and women's issues. And her and a lot of other suffragists realized that everything they were fighting for, public health, women's education, really wouldn't, nothing would happen with those issues unless women had the vote.
Goucher College was then known as the Women's College of Baltimore.
Yes, right? Until 1910.
And it wasn't co-ed until the 80s,
yeah,
right?
86, exactly. So, yeah, she had students meet Susan B. Anthony for that convention. She really organized all their actions.
And you researched quite a few of the students,
yes,
who participated.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of them.
That's actually how the project started. We were just supposed to write biographies for the students that participated in the picket. And then it kind of catapulted to this whole project. But one of the main students who really was involved with the movement at Goucher was Ida Glatt. She graduated in 1917. She almost didn't graduate because of her interest in the Socialist Party and her tendencies like that. She worked for non-conscription. She was very controversial. But she goes on after graduation to work for a labor party. She became part of the Communist Party in California. She did a lot of things with labor rights and labor organizations.
Who else?
A lot of the students that participated ended up being teachers, social workers. That was a big trend. We had 13 names that we confirmed, but there were about 30 Goucher students who participated in the picket.
Elaine Weiss, what kind of risks were these students taking in participating in the picket again of the White House?
They were taking rather substantial risks, not just for the reputation of the school, but personally. The pickets were never arrested for picketing per se, because picketing is a protected constitutional right. They were arrested for trumped up charges, loitering or traffic violations, blocking the sidewalk. And so the police are really trying to shut them down. It's a time of enormous civil rights violations all over the nation. The American Civil Liberties Union is formed to protect protesters and conscientious objectors and those who are being thrown into prison. So the women who were picketing, Goucher was participating in this really brilliant PR campaign of the National Women's Party, which they had college days. So they had college students from women's colleges and co-ed colleges. They'd have a day to demonstrate. And that's how, so this was part of a college day. They, I don't believe, were arrested at that time. But soon after, the arrests begin. There are almost 500 women who are arrested, and about almost 200 are placed in jail. Some of them given six-month sentences for obstructing the sidewalk. It's cockroach infested. They go on hunger strikes because they think they are political prisoners, not common criminals. Alice Paul is put into solitary confinement, and there's an effort to rule her insane. It's very, very violent, not outside. Their protests aren't violent. Within the prison, it's very violent. They were also risking the denunciation by their families, by their friends, by their social networks. So they were taking quite a risk, as civil rights activists do.
Quick break now on the record. Elaine Weiss is going to stick with us. Hannah Spiegelman, I really appreciate your telling us about Goucher's involvement in women's.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Hannah Spiegelman graduated from Goucher College in 2015. She helped create an exhibit about Goucher's participation in women's suffrage. When we're back, did you know that the 19th Amendment wasn't ratified in Maryland until 1958? We'll talk about the Free State's fervent opposition to granting women the right to vote. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the struggle for women's suffrage and how it came to be. With me is writer Elaine Weiss, whose book about women winning the vote will be published next spring, a couple years ahead of the centennial of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. I want to step back a moment to go a little bit deeper into what were the arguments against giving women the vote?
The most potent is that women were to be subservient to men. Some interpret this as God's plan. This is biblical. And women have their own sphere. They're to be domestic. They can be the queen of the castle, but they're not to step outside. So this idea of women's sphere not being in the public square, but in the home, is very, very powerful. We still see it now.
The 15th Amendment, ratified in 1870, gave voting rights to black men, said that race, color, and previous condition of servitude could not keep one from voting. And that there were quite a few whites in the country who were not comfortable with that for decades. Was that a big factor in holding back women's vote?
Yes, it was. The women suffragists who are deeply involved in the abolition movement and pushing President Lincoln to emancipate the slaves, and they assume, and they're led to believe, perhaps naively, that when the war is over and when black men are given their rights, that there'll be universal suffrage, that all men and women will have the rights of citizenship, which includes voting rights. And when the 15th Amendment is drawn up, the word male appears for the first time in the Constitution. Nowhere in the U.S. Constitution does it say that only men can vote. It was just always assumed that only men could vote. So now it says that you can't deny the vote because of race and previous servitude and all these things that will make it clear that black men have the vote. And Anthony and Stanton say, wait a second, why don't we take out that word male and just say that you can't deny the vote on account of sex? And they're told no. And so they actually campaign against ratification of the 15th Amendment. It's a very bitter and truly, if we look at it today, embarrassing moment in the suffrage movement, because they say if women can't get the vote, they don't want black men to get the vote either. And this sort of carries through into 1920 when it's coming to a head. The other thing to mention is that there's not only kind of social mores and traditions that work against most people accepting women in this kind of position, but there are corporate interests that are opposed to suffrage. And those were the liquor interests, brewing, distilleries, saloons, because many of the women in the suffrage movement were also in the temperance movement. The other corporate interests that are aligned against suffrage are the railroads.
Why?
The railroads needed state and congressional approvals to have eminent domain and land given to put tracks through. There were all kinds of legislative favors they needed to be able to both expand across the country and then to thrive in their own regions. You know, this was a whole unpredictable element. You were doubling the electorate, doubling it, and no one knew how women would vote.
That's author Elaine Weiss here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. She has written a book to be published next spring about women's suffrage. We're talking about the end of the suffrage movement and Maryland's opposition to the 19th Amendment. Let's jump forward to that. Congress passes the 19th Amendment in 1919. It goes to the states. By the spring of the next year, 35 states have ratified, one state short of the three-fourths necessary. And then what happens?
Well, Maryland refuses to ratify, and so it does not become one of the three-quarters of the states needed to ratify. It comes down to a southern state. It comes down to Tennessee. And so the great battle of the last state happens in the summer of 1920 in Tennessee. But Maryland is greatly involved in that. The Maryland legislature refuses to ratify the 19th Amendment in the winter of 1920. They vote it down. Maryland is a railroad state. There's lots of manufacturing going on here. The predominant, I would say, fear of women's suffrage here is also racial. There's great antipathy towards the idea that if all women are given the vote, black women will be given the vote, and then the mechanisms that have been put in place to inhibit black men from voting, who on paper can vote, but are being intimidated and harassed at the polling place. And so there's this sense that if the 19th Amendment passes, if the federal government can now oversee elections, this begins to sound very familiar to us in the present day, that Washington might force, especially the southern states, to allow not only black women, but black men to vote. And they didn't want that.
Tell us about William Marbury.
William Marbury is a very distinguished Maryland attorney. And he is greatly in opposition to women's suffrage for many reasons. I think he truly doesn't believe women should be out in the mire of politics, as it's put at the time. But he also represents in his law practice railroads, manufacturers, liquor interests. So he has a lot of reasons that he would be opposed to it. He is very active in the men's anti-suffrage organization. And so when the Maryland legislature refuses to ratify, they not only reject the amendment, but they then vote to send emissaries from the legislature, often accompanied by William Marbury, to other state legislatures, especially in the South, who are considering ratification, to convince them to reject it. And Marbury also helps fashion legal opposition so that there are injunctions filed to not allow, even when it is ratified, they try to stop its implementation. They fight it both at on the Maryland state level and then all these other state levels. And then they finally do. He's involved in fighting it at the federal level, even after it wins ratification. It goes all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, after the amendment was ratified, a Maryland judge, Judge Oscar Lesser, sued to get two women who had registered to vote off the voter rolls.
Correct.
On grounds of what?
That it was against the Maryland Constitution. The Maryland Constitution still said male, that only male citizens were allowed to vote. And he said, well, that's fine. Your 19th Amendment may have said this, but in Maryland, we don't let women vote. So I think that's a very simplistic analysis, but that was pretty much what he was saying, that this goes against state. States' rights was a big issue in this whole federal women's suffrage amendment. States, especially in the South, still smarting from the Civil War, saying, we don't want Washington coming in here and telling us who can vote in our state. It's still going on, as we know, but that's part of the legal challenge that they were making.
Very briefly, after ratification, did women vote in big numbers?
They did vote. They didn't vote in as big a numbers as the suffragists had hoped. Part of it is the 19th Amendment isn't ratified until late in August of 1920, and there's a presidential election in the first week of November. So they have about 10 weeks to organize and get women registered. The numbers are not impressive for quite a few years, and the suffragists are frankly disappointed that not that many women are voting. And there's all kinds of reasons that are speculated for that.
Yeah, lots more we could talk about. I really appreciate you walking us through it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sheila.
Elaine Weiss is a journalist and author. Her last book, Fruits of Victory, covers the unusual history of the Women's Land Army and how it worked to feed the nation during World War I. Her latest work, expected next March, is about winning women's suffrage in the United States. Earlier, we spoke with Hannah Spiegelman, who graduated from Goucher College in 2015. She helped create the exhibit, A Nursery for Militant Suffragists, The History of the Women's Suffrage Movement at Goucher College, which is on display at the school's library. We've got a link to that from our page at wypr.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.